Hello, my name's Ian Danta. This is The Commentator's Curse. This is the podcast where I chat with commentator pals who I've met in press boxes up and down the country. I've been doing this job as a football commentator for over 20 years now on local and national radio. Every single person I meet has a different story to tell about how they got there and how they've stayed there. And they've always got great stories to tell about the period in between. There's an archive of episodes that you can check out. There's seven previous episodes. So we're quite a way into this already, starting with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker, which was episode one, way back when, up to number seven, which was Tom Ross and Nigel Adley. That's the most recent one. But let me introduce my two guests for today on The Commentator's Curse. My first guest is a man I really got to know well about 5 years ago, when he finally realised a life's ambition as his country, Wales, got to a major tournament for the first time. And we worked together very closely on that tournament, and we've become very good friends since. He's been the doyen of Welsh radio commentary for I don't know how long. This is one of the things I want to delve into with Rob Phillips, who's with us. Hello, Rob.
Doyen, I really sound old now, don't I, Dan? Welcome. Thank you.
That wasn't the intention. Don't worry, Rob. I was trying to be nice. And my other guest is a proper trailblazer for women's football in terms of commentary. She's actually as much of a host these days as she is a commentator. She's been front and centre with so many different broadcasts, apart from TalkSport, actually, where I work. I don't think we've ever managed to persuade her. But whether ITV, Sky...
You wouldn't have me.
Okay, well, there we go. Contract negotiations underway as we speak with Jackie Oatley. All right, Bab.
All right, Bab.
It's nice to speak to you both. Jackie, I know that this is a particularly busy time for you with the advent of the WSL and the broadcast rights that have been given over to broadcasters like Sky. This is just a whole new level for you to get into the women's football that you've been advocating for so long now.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's so nice to be part of it. Really, really is. And it's just phenomenal to see how far the women's game has come since I started reporting on it and commentating on it back in 2004, when, of course, it wasn't remotely a professional sport or professional league, certainly not in this country, that's for sure. And it's grown year on year in all this time. And now is the time that it's ready for full-on Super Sunday status and BBC One, BBC Two coverage. And it wasn't ready back then. It wasn't just a case of the broadcasters weren't up for it. It just wasn't ready. Whereas now it is. And the most exciting thing for me about this new broadcast deal is the fact that we're showing so much more analysis. There's so much more time to analyse the actual football rather than to just gloss over the top of it. And also the fact that there's so much development still to come. And if anybody saw the Women's Champions League during the week, I was at the Chelsea-Wolfsburg game last night as we speak, but the Barcelona-Arsenal game, there's clearly a long way to go in terms of the development. And I think that's exciting. It's only going to get bigger, better, bigger crowds. And I'm glad to be a tiny part of it.
Yeah, it is great. I mean, you've got stories of Karen Carney taking the SkyPad home so she could learn how to, you know, use it and do all the sweeping and pressing buttons and things like that. Is that something you've got to get into as well? Is that going to be part of your skill set?
No. I'm just at the matches, calling the game. So I'm in this little room, as you can see. I've recently converted. Well, not converted, but it is a loft conversion, and it just was for guests before. But now it's my little haven of tranquility where I can just try and sneak a few hours a day to just have some peace and quiet, get down and dirty with the stats, and just get really, really into the nuts and bolts of the teams and the managers and the players and their backgrounds. And it's fascinating. I'm loving really getting stuck into the in-depth nature of the games and the commentary. And then I leave Caroline Barker in the studio to do all the punditry stuff, which is fascinating to listen to as well.
There's much more awareness now, isn't there, Jackie? Yeah, and we noticed it in Wales under Jane Ludlow. She had this team that gelled together, you know, with the likes of Jess Fishlock and Harriet James and people like that. And they became a cause. Remember when they drew 0-0 with England at Southampton? Just a phenomenal defensive display down there. I was there that night. But they were, what I loved about that team, and it's going to be the same with Gemma Granger. She's inherited the team off Jane, who's gone to Manchester City now. But they've become sort of so well known. not just in the women's game. And that was partly because they bought into it. They realized they were on a crusade. So they never turned down any media sort of opportunities. They really did realize it was more than just trying to bring on women's football at the top level. It was, well, if we make an effect now and make an impact now, it'll encourage more youngsters to join the game. And, you know, you show a picture of Jess Fishlock next to Aaron Ramsey, people know who she is now, which wouldn't have happened when Jane Ludlow was a terrific player for Wales, but hardly anybody watched them.
It was mad because I used to watch Jane Ludlow at Arsenal at Boreham Wood back in the day. I'm actually commentating alongside her tomorrow at Arsenal. And she was an incredible box-to-box player. You ask anybody in that team, and the character as well. I think she ran that dressing room from what I've heard.
She was a tank, wasn't she? Yeah.
Wow, what a character. And I think you've seen that now in her management as well. And you hear it on the analysis that she... But it's just a shame that players such as her and Kelly Smith didn't have the opportunities and the coaching and the just everything that the players now have. And I think some of them, there's been talk about them maybe not quite appreciating what the generation before didn't have and what they did for them. But it's just great now that this generation do have all those opportunities.
Just before we delve back into your histories, whilst we're on this topic, Jackie, as you mentioned, 2004 was when you first started covering women's football before the advent of the WSL that we have now. Just how... For want of a better word, ramshackle was it, you know, when you were turning up to games as a commentator in those days compared to the strides that the game has made now?
Oh, Dan, well, you've taken me back now. The show in England thumped a couple of teams recently, North Macedonia and Luxembourg. It reminded me of their record victory, which was 13-0 away to Hungary. And that day I was broadcasting out a window in Hungary, in Topolca, and it was some sort of classroom or office or something, and it just made me laugh because we didn't have press boxes or anything. And there was one, I think my favourite one was in Austria, and they'd made it, they ticked the boxes for UEFA, so it had the basics, like a pitch and a dugout, that was it, basically. But just next door was a community Astro facility, which all these players were kicking balls around on, had no idea that a full-on international was going on next door. But my commentary box was overlooking the AstroTurf that the local kids were kicking balls around on, and I couldn't literally see the pitch because it was next door to where I was. So things like that, you have to laugh, but that's where the ISDN box was. And so I just had to use the longest vision that I had and hope for the best. And there was no Twitter or anything in those days. We're talking about the mid-2000s. And as England tried to qualify for the 2007 World Cup, which they did. And it was just hilarious because there just wasn't any facilities. Nobody thought about media. They didn't expect any media to be going to games. So you just got on with it. But we had this little cabal of mostly Wolverhampton Wanderers supporters in the media that went to. So we had Pete Lansley from The Times, and there's Tony Layton, who covered it for the FA and freelance for The Guardian and what have you. And when we used to sort of pop around the world covering England women, and it was brilliant. And it was all the Hope Powell era, 15 years of it. And they did finally qualify for the World Cup 2007, reached the Euro final in 2009, which a lot of people won't realise wasn't on TV until the final. And I was the only person covering women's football for the BBC in those days. And I kept nagging my boss at Five Live, go, can I go? No, not until they get to the semi-final, if they do. They got to the semi-final, right, can I go now? Like, no, you can sit in the 606 studio with Spoonie and watch it on a tiny screen and put your hand up if a goal scored. I was like, Jill Scott scored, right, can I go for the final? And suddenly they pulled out all the stops for the final and England got thumped by the Germans 6-2. But that's how it was. And it's just great now to see how far it's come since then in terms of everything.
That's character building, that is, Jack. Character building, commentating on a game next door that you can probably see. Good, that's like that binoculars, telescope, I don't know, or just your natural eyesight.
Oh, it's just, luckily I knew the England players well, but I mean, whenever we go to a game now, and if everybody's got short, dark hair, whatever, like my first ever commentary in non-league, which was horrendously hard in comparison, I think trying to identify players in a different postcode to where you're actually plugged into your ISDN is one of the greater challenges.
I've done it once at Ponty. Rob will know Ponty Pool. Colin Murray once organised a game for the TalkSport All-Stars against Ponty Pool. It was something that he organised. And at Ponty Pool, the commentary box was behind the one goal. And it was the floodlights weren't the strongest. And I was having to commentate on this game. The ball went up the other end. Absolute hit and hope.
I've actually commentated behind the goal a couple of times. One at Boston years ago, because their commentary box was also behind the goal. And also a few years ago, when Newport County were non-league, they played Blackpool in the FA Cup. And Blackpool were having one stand sorted at Bloomfield Road. So we commentated behind the goal. And I don't want to get technical, but how do you describe? You sort of say, don't we? We say, Cardiff or Swansea are playing Cardiff, all in blue, and playing from left to right. But actually, they're coming straight at me.
Thanks
it's
from
really bizarre.
Near.
Yeah, you don't know how to describe it. Cardiff are breaking for, and it puts you all out as far as, I mean, typically Newport County, they scored at the other end from where I was to take it to a replay. But it was such a bizarre experience commentating behind the goal.
Now, Rob, let's go back to the very beginning. So how far are we going back to when you began your career in radio? And was that always the plan from when you were a lad, or did circumstances throw you that way?
I started off in newspapers. So started off on the, did my A-levels, joined the local newspaper, the Rhondda Leader, Pontypridd The Observer, which is where I was brought up, that area. One of my first managers who I dealt with was a manager of Blind Rhondda, a guy called Winford Ludlow, father of
Jane Ludlow.
We've been talking about, how strange is that? I got on really well with them. We're on great trips, even though we have great trips now, they were great trips at Blind Rhondda. Then I moved to the Western Morning News in Plymouth, then the Argus in Newport to cover my team I'd supported as a boy, Newport County, which was a dream come true for me. Then I moved on to The Echo in Cardiff for 10 years, covering Cardiff and sometimes Merthyr. Actually, Newport County lost in the Welsh Cup final that summer I left, beaten by Merthyr. My first trip with The Echo was with Merthyr to Atalanta in the Cup Winners' Cup. Do you remember that famous occasion as well? Now you've got me. That would be 97, I think. And then 10 years on The Echo had a sort of invite. I'd done stuff for Radio Wales and BBC Wales, and they said, do you fancy coming on board? So I had to apply, go through the interview process. And that was 20-odd years ago. And by dint of people leaving, I became the football correspondent. And actually, you know, Wales has always been my big thing. As much as I loved Swansea in the Premier League for 7 years, Cardiff in the Premier League a couple of years. You know, I love watching Newport, I love watching Wrexham, I love watching football. It's my passion, it's my job. But actually, Wales has always been, even when Wales weren't successful, they were always a source of great stories, and B, what I thought was the, you know, I was going from watching Cardiff City in Division 4 to suddenly watching Ian Rush and Neville Southall, and such was the setup with Wales. You know, my first Wales game, I ended up having a couple of drinks with a few of them. And this was just, I was just open-mouthed at this. I couldn't believe it. And so that's how it started. And I think I've covered the really golden era. You know, you talked about meeting you in the Euros in 2016, obviously. And that was just an unbelievable adventure, which we didn't realise was going to happen. We'd waited 58 years for it. And we were at the centre of it, and it was just an amazing, amazing. It was an odyssey, really. It really was an odyssey, which I always say to my kids, you know, one of them was born in the summer, but that was the best summer of my life. And I make no apologies for saying that. And they sort of get it now. They get it now.
Well, it was as much the qualification campaign that took Wales there. And I'm thinking from a commentator's point of view, you'd watched Wales. I started coming in to watch Wales much, much later. And it was pretty much that qualification campaign where I was coming to the Cardiff City Stadium to watch them. But for you guys, you'd suffered the disappointments at the Millennium Stadium against like Russia, I think it would have been one of the big disappointments when you were so close to a major tournament. Give me a perspective of what it was like as a commentator, particularly given the clear love that you have for your country, about this, how close you came with that actually making it for tournament after tournament after tournament.
Well, as a fan, I remember 78, the Joe Jordan handball at Anfield. I remember 85, I think it was Davy Cooper's penalty at Ninian Park. I remember I covered Romania in 93 when I was on a newspaper, The Echo. That was tragic as well as heartbreaking on a football sense, although Romania were brilliant. Then in 2003, I was there with BBC for the draw in Moscow and then the defeat to Russia. Next stop would have been the Euros in 2004. And so finally to come to this, and if you remember, Wales started off in Andorra, were a goal down at the start, the very start of the qualification campaign in Andorra. I remember being in the commentary box and at halftime walked past a few FAW councillors who were, you know, Chris Coleman was struggling at that time. And I said to one of them, if we lose this, you're going to have a decision to make on the manager, aren't you? And he didn't demur from it. He just said, nodded his head and walked off. And then, if you remember, Gareth Bale got Wales back into it and then had a free kick, which hit the wall, was taken again, and he put it in. And from that, the adventure started and didn't look back until the semi-finals. It was extraordinary. It was an extraordinary trip. The red wall developed into something, you know, of Wales fans. And as a commentator, it was that sense of the unknown. You know, suddenly things were happening both on and off the pitch. So imagine you're a commentator like me. You're seeing Wales qualify for the first time in 58 years for a major tournament, before even I was born. And you sort of, you feel you want to nail the big moment, but the big moment was a defeat and we had to wait for a scoreline from somewhere else to actually qualify. And then just to get there, you just think, I think then the adrenaline kicks in and you're at this tournament and Wales played a blinder. They were fantastic with the media. They really lapped it up. Even the sort of possibly embarrassing bits about celebrating England's defeat by Iceland, they laughed that off. Gareth Bale came to the fore as not just a leader on the pitch, but a leader off it, in front of the media sort of thing. It was almost perfect. And it only ended on my birthday when Ronaldo intervened for Portugal. And so, but it was just never to be forgotten, Dan. Never to be forgotten.
We will talk more about the Euros and France and the specifics of that as we go on. But Jackie, I want to come back to you because your route into broadcasting, I don't know whether it was caused by an injury you had as a player, because you were playing just for fun once you'd moved to London, because broadcasting wasn't the original intention when you graduated?
Oh, no, not at all. Only because I hadn't thought about it and I hadn't considered it and I hadn't believed that I could do something like that. So... yeah, so I'd come through school as a football obsessive, mostly in an all-girls school, and then for sixth form in a virtually all-boys school. And went off to university at 17, did a German degree, which ultimately happened to be a great choice. But at the time, I only made that choice because I could speak German. I thought it was going to be an easy ride for 4 years. How wrong I was. It was blinking hard with all the medieval German literature, which wasn't even German. It was before it became German. So that was hideous. And finished, travelled around the world for a year, thinking, like most people do, oh, by the time I get back, I'll have worked out what I want to do. Still hadn't. And fell into something via a language agency, recruitment agency, and that was intellectual property, sales marketing, and latterly key account management. Not what I wanted to do. And like lots of people who get to their mid to late 20s think, oh, is this it? Is this it? Is this my life now? Is this what I was supposed to do? And no, it wasn't. And I still had this thing in the back of my mind that I just felt somehow that I was going to do something interesting with my work life, but I just didn't know what that was. And I'd never joined the dots between being a football obsessive, a sport lover, and being into grammar, words, and loving radio, as I as I did, I used to have my little earpiece in when I used to go and watch my team play football home and away on the terraces. And I'd always have, it was before digital radios, obviously, it was the little mini ones that I had in my pocket, and always listen to radio updates while I was there, and always listen to BBC WM at any away games I couldn't get to as I was growing up. And so I loved the broadcasting, but never thought I'd actually do it. I was more of a listener. And so really it was something that developed as I was getting less and less happy with the work that I was doing. And I did have that awful knee injury when I dislocated my kneecap, ruptured the ligaments, crutches for 10 months, lots of operations, a big old reconstruction, and was told I couldn't play again. And that gave me time to think quite how much I despised the job I was doing, as much as what do I really want to do with my life? And really I was thinking, I would love to do what those people on the radio do, go to matches on a Saturday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday and tell people what's happening at home. And I just thought, I'd love to do that, but what is it? How do people get into that? I didn't have the faintest idea. I didn't know anybody that did it, not on the radio side. I was actually friends with Johnny Phillips of Sky Sports, but I wasn't interested in TV. I really wanted to do radio. And so I just read people's biographies on the internet and I thought, what did these people do to be able to get into broadcasting? And of course, everybody, as we know from this podcast, I've been listening to them avidly, by the way, fascinated by people's different routes. And some of them seem to be called up by friends saying, hey, there's a job going down at the local radio station. I was thinking, that sounds great. There was none of that though. So how lucky is that? So yeah, I just read all these biographies, made notes and saw that Pete Stevens at BBC London, his biography said that he'd started in hospital radio. I thought, that's a good idea. So I literally contacted my local hospital radio, which was Charing Cross Hospital in Hammersmith, Fulham, just across the road from Fulham's ground, and said, hi, can I come in? And they said, yeah, come in on a whatever day it was. And so I went in there once a week and did a sports report that I'd written sneakily at my desk in the afternoon, lifted mostly from the BBC Sport website, tweaked for broadcast, and went to WH Smith and looked at Floodlight magazine and just scrolled through there. What courses were there? Because I'd seen other people had got in via journalist qualifications. And introduction to print journalism, I thought that'll do. Once a week for 6 months, 3 hours every Thursday night. So I did that, paid my 150 quid or whatever it was. Loved that. It was all the basics about how to become a journalist. And through the hospital radio, I was told about another evening course, which was introduction to radio production. So I did all these courses, and then that ended up in a restricted service license station popping up in Hammersmith for 3 weeks. And I thought, I really want to be part of that. And asked them if I could be involved. And they said, yes. And I said, could I do a sports show, please? And they said, yeah, sure. Do what you like. Anyone who's able to work on it. And I thought, oh, that clashes with work time because I've got a proper job. And I thought, I know, I'll just resign from my job and I'll go and work for 3 weeks full time as a sports presenter on this RSL station in Hammersmith. And I thought, well, if I do that, then I won't have any income. And I thought, well, if I don't have any income, then I won't be able to pay my rent. So I thought, I know, I'll resign from my flat and then I won't have anywhere to live. That's a good idea. So no income, nowhere to live, but I will have 3 weeks on an RSL station. So I did that. I rang around my friends and said, I've got this idea, which I think is a really good one. And any chance I can keep on your floor for a few nights at a time. And luckily all my friends, because it was before the days of anyone having spare rooms or anything, we're all flat sharing in London at different stages. I was 27 at this point. And so I would literally pack a bag of duvet, a pillow, a sleeping bag, and sleep on friends' landings for a few days at a time, while writing to anybody I could think of to ask for a few days' work experience. Because I thought, if I'm going to do this career change, I need to do it properly, full on, full time. And so that's what I did. I managed to get a few days at Haters, which was absolutely brilliant, the sports news agency. And I shadowed them at press conferences. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I loved asking managers questions. And I remember going to a Glenn Hoddle one at Tottenham and asked a question. And that story, then his answer was in the paper the next day. And for me, that was a big, big buzz. It really, really was.
What was the question?
Oh, it wasn't very exciting. It was something about Jason Kumas and whether he'd ever tried to sign him. And he said, actually, yes, I had. And that was the story into the game they were playing the next day, and the fact that Hoddle had tried to sign him ahead of him playing him. So it wasn't wild, but it was still exciting for me. And so I went to all these presses and I chatted to the guys at Haters, and I ended up getting some story about a friend of a friend who'd had a £10 bet at the World Cup in 2002, and he'd won £100,000 from a £10 bet. And that story got picked up in, was it the Racing Post or the Sporting Life or something, one of those. And again, just the buzz of your story making it. I thought, right, this is definitely what I want to do, but I'm not earning any money here. I'm only spending it. I've got nowhere to live. I'm literally kipping on friends' floors. So I thought, well, what's the next step? Because I can't just get a job from just having a module qualification of introduction to print journalism and a radio production mini qualification. So I thought, I went along to an event that Nina Hossain from ITN was involved with in Barron's Court at a university around there. And I queued up at the end of this event to tell her about my dilemma. And I said, look, I'm doing this. I'm doing full-time work experience. I'm 27. I'm living off savings. And what do I do next? How do I get a job? Or if I don't get a job, what do I do? And she said, because I said, should I go back to university and do a postgrad? And she said, well, why don't you apply for jobs and apply for the course? And if you haven't got a job by the time the course starts, then take the course. I thought it was a brilliant idea. I ran back to my flat and or to wherever I was at the time. I can't remember. And I just remember getting a load of brochures that I discounted, thinking I wouldn't do this course. And I wrote to all these places saying, right, really short notice, have you got any places? And only Sheffield Hallam University had a place left. So I went up there, did some tests or whatever it was. And they said, yep, you can have a place. And that was it. I up sticks, moved to Sheffield. Left my boyfriend, feel a bit guilty, but it was the right thing for both, I think. sorry, Jim.
But collateral damage.
I hope he's very happy now. I hope I'm sure he's much happier. And yeah, went up to Sheffield and got a room with a load of 21-year-olds and I was 27 turning 28 and just threw everything into this postgrad. And I just loved it. And I thought, this is what I want to do. And I learned how to ask questions. I learned how to use a mini disc recorder. I learned all about news journalism. I learned about building contacts. And sorry, this is a longer version than I planned, and started writing to all the local BBC news stations saying, hi, can I have some work experience? And BBC TV News invited me in for 2 days, which was really my breakthrough. They replied saying, yep, you can have 2 days. And I thought, well, like, if I get in there, then I'm in the building and I can hopefully collar the sports editor and explain to him that I just love to do sport. If I could, can I come in and see him? And he said, well, we've got no one to do the non-league. Would you be interested in a 10, 15 minute slot on a Saturday? I said, yes, please. And so I went up and did voice tests and aptitude tests. And he said, yep, you can do it. And I worked my way up from there. I made non-league football in West Yorkshire my patch. And from that moment on, for £21 a week, I was completely hooked on journalism. And I did some news journalism as well and freelanced all over the country at BBC WM and had a bit of a nightmare with a radio car and A to Z. Driving around Birmingham and Coventry at 5 o'clock in the morning was utterly terrifying, trying to get to this fire and all these memories of just working really, really hard and taking any opportunity that came along and working my way up from there.
Well, look, Jack, it's a great story. And I try not to interrupt on this podcast because people have got to get, there's so many little sliding doors moments that people have. Sounds like you've had about 20 in fairness, just to get to that point alone. You brought up something, a couple of things really interesting. Listening with an earpiece, you know, whilst you're doing other work. I used to do that when I was selling guitars on a Saturday. The boss said, right, because he was as nutty about football as I was. And he said, right, you can have a little earpiece in Saturday afternoon. You can tell us what the scores are. So I'd have Capital Gold on, Tom Ross, listening to the goals going in. And I'd be handling these expensive guitars. I nearly dropped a £4,000 Gibson Les Paul because Birmingham won a penalty whilst I was handing it to him. So I love that. The cockeyed intensity of listening to football on an earpiece when you're meant to be doing something entirely different. I love that, and I completely relate to that. But Robert, you must know about the radio car. There's Jackie mentioning the radio car. Everyone at BBC Wales must have had a whole fleet of the things.
We had a radio bus. We had a bus. So it would go to various events. The Royal Welsh Show was one of them. And That was something to behold, because the guests would actually get on the bus to do interviews or whatever. So and if the bus had a problem, there was a real problem on outside broadcast. And I mentioned the Royal Welsh Show because, you know, we have to do everything in this game. I only commentate on football now, but what they used to do at the Royal Welsh Show is they give children a chance to commentate on games. So they'd have a film of a few tries and a few goals. And so I would be there, and they'd say, Rob will show you how it's done, and then you have a go. Well, some of them were really good. Some of them were really good. But then they said, well, you've got a few hours off now. So for the afternoon programme, any chance you can go and commentate on something a bit different? I said, well, what do you want me to do? So they said, there's an angling lesson going on over in one part of the Royal Welsh Show. And also, we'd like you to commentate on the sheep shearing. And the last one was the wood chopping. Have you ever tried to commentate on wood chopping?
No.
I mean,
go on, give us a go.
There was no stats. And it was an interesting concept. And the sheep shearing was, well, that was something different. And they were really good at it. But you tried saying that to a radio audience, just how good they are at shearing a sheep. Yeah. It was interesting. But the radio bus was something else. But and the Royal Welsh Show is an event. You have to go. I didn't think I'd be into it, but when I got there, it was really big for BBC Wales as well, both TV and radio. But that was a first. Well, the three firsts: commentating on sheep shearing, angling, and wood chopping.
Yeah, it's like World of Sport with Dickie Davies in the
quite.
Welsh World of Sport.
So you've got the lot.
And I've got to tell you this one, Jackie. You talk about work experience. You have to be careful with work experience, people. So I'd been out commentating through the week, and on Friday afternoon, I was back in the office. So, and I hadn't been in there all the week. And there were a couple of work experience in the corner. And you know, they sit there, and they apparently I got to. I went to off. I said, "Well, who wants tea? Who wants coffee?" It was my round. There was a machine there. So I ran across this girl who was there on work experience. I said, "Sorry," I said, "I haven't been here all the week. I don't know who you are." She said her name. I said, "Oh, I'm Rob Phillips." She said, "I know who you are." She said. I said, "All right." And she said, "Yeah, you used to go out with my mother." And I did, in Ponty, yeah. So I saw a small world. And would you believe it, that moment in the office all went quiet and everybody looked up and they were checking whether she looked like me.
Yeah, work experience, we used to call them at the guitar shop where I used to work.
Yeah.
Work experience. We used to call them mouth breathers. They just used to put the vac round, you know, and very, very lazily, no effort being put into cleaning the guitar shop floor. Work experience in radio, I grant you, is very different. You do get a lot of people who come in on work experience who are so, so keen, like you must have been, Jackie, to soak up everything. Yes, there are a couple of work experience people that come in and they think the world owes them a living, but they're few and far between. Most people who come into radio, they're working for free and they know it, they understand the rules, but my word, they want to get stuck in.
Yeah, well, I think it's such an opportunity, work experience, because if you sit there and you don't say boo to a goose, then people will just forget you, really. They're not going to be struck by what you have to offer. And as we all know, this is such a competitive industry to get into that I think it's tricky for work experience people, because on the one hand, you don't want to be too keen and annoy people by being in their face the whole time. But on the other hand, you do have to make an impression and you do have to make the most of the situation. And I always say to students when they ask about how you get in, I say primarily just try to get in front of people so you have an opportunity to make an impression. And I know it's more difficult during COVID times and things are easing a little bit now, but at least we have Zoom. We're all looking at each other from different parts of the country on Zoom. And if you try to at least have a Zoom meeting with somebody from an organisation who can tell you a little bit about their work, or if you are allowed in the building, or better still, if you can get somewhere open air where they're happy to chat to you. I think once you're in front of somebody, you can show them what you can do. Whereas I think people who apply for jobs after university and wait for an answer, they're going to be waiting a long time, because the people who have what it takes to succeed are actually cracking on. They're doing stuff. They're recording stuff into their mobile phones and sending tapes. They're setting up their own websites. They're writing blogs. They're actually doing stuff rather than just talking about it or applying for jobs?
Now, we'll talk about the people that you guys, you, Jackie, and you, Rob, are sort of, you know, mentoring, the people that look up to you. But who did you two look up to in terms of broadcasting as mentors? Were there any people that specifically guided you in your early days as a commentator, if we think about commentary specifically, Rob?
The best bit of BBC training I had was in London, and it was taken by Ron Jones, who I sort of knew Ron from newspaper days. You know, I'd met him on the circuit. But it was brilliant. We had a day of sort of how do you do prep and stuff like that. And then they took us to a game, and there were eight of us, I think, on the course. And we did a quarter, two of us did a quarter of the game each. And it was the best bit of training, because they also told us how to write for radio as well, and which is a totally different art to, or skill to, writing for a newspaper. But Ron Jones, and actually I'll say it for Ron, I've not spoken to him for a while, but actually he would, if I get rusty, or if I feel I'm getting rusty, I know I can almost pick up the phone to Ron and say, can you have a listen? I've done it. I've said, can you have a listen for a couple of games? And I just feel a bit, I'm using the same phrases over and over again. We get regular sort of Rob Knopfman, who many people know, often works on the racing on Radio 5. He will come down and he'll listen to games. You send him a demo, the tape of a game you've done, and he'll listen. For instance, how often you give the score line, how often you give identity to the radio station you're working for. But I think it's fantastic. And even down to, and this is where, you know, I've heard you say before, Dance, that you may be sort of, rivals is the wrong word, but you go to a press box, you're working for one radio station, I'm working there for another, but we're all in the same game. And actually, a couple of years ago, I used to do all my commentary prep. I used to write it all out, and I'd have stickers for each player. Mm-hmm. But I had a disaster in the Wales-USA game when it was one of those friendlies where they could have so many subs. You know, there was unlimited number of subs. And there was a gust of wind, and my stickers blew away. So, on the Americans.
Oh, no.
So I thought, right. I've seen people with electronic, with everything typed out, nicely done. I know you do yours handwritten. I know you do yours handwritten, Dance, but I was looking and I'm thinking, right, I've been wondering about this. I think I'll start to do all my stuff electronically now, which was a big move for me, a big move. But you know what I did? I asked Steve Wilson of Match of the Day, I saw him at a game and I said, is there any chance? I said, I'm thinking about going over to electronic preparation for games and all my prep on sheets of paper without stickers and things. Can you send me a copy of your prep for a game? I did it for him. I asked him. I asked Sam Matterface as well. And they both obliged. And I thought, they'll do for me, both of those two. And I'm older. I'm probably older than both of them, but I'm still young learning on the commentary game. And I always say that. You're never too old to pick up sort of hints and doing things better. And I still think now, I listen to Steve Wilson, I wish I could commentate like him. I think he's brilliant. I like Sam Matterface on radio. I like you, Dance, on radio, I'll be honest. So I like to think, and I might hear a phrase that maybe you use, and I think, yeah, I've got to think about that phrase for the next time. Or,
yeah, I've got to stop it really, because I've started using two lemons make a strawberry for when a player gets a second yellow card and gets a red. For some reason, I've started, somebody sent me a file, I've done it about six or seven times in the last year. I've got to cut it out, because it's a bit too self-indulgent, really. But you're right there, Rob, hands across the airwaves and everything for information that can be, you know, transferred between, you know, BBC and ILR. There's lots of friendships and whatnot. Jackie, if I can come back to you, when the big break came to become a television commentator and work for the BBC, and you've told that story so many times about, you know, getting onto Match of the Day and everything, the furore and the headlines that went with it. When we talk about hands across the airwaves, like I was just there with Rob, how were you received in the press box? I'm really interested to know how your peers, the peer group that you were suddenly in amongst, how quickly they accepted you, or did you get that feeling of a cold shoulder or reticence in those early days?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think, no, not a cold shoulder, but I'm also not daft. I'm quite sure that there would have been some colleagues, and I'm pretty sure I know who they would have been as well, who... And I heard actually somebody in the Five Live office, somebody I get on really well with, who was talking to his producer at the time saying, oh God, imagine if there's a female commentator. Oh, can't imagine that. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting across the way thinking, I'm a commentator in local radio. I was just doing a bit of Five Live freelancing at the time, but I was a commentator. I had been doing some at Radio Leeds, and I was thinking I wanted to carry on doing this. And I just thought, oh, I've got all this to come. And then when it happened, yes, I got the vibe from maybe one or two. And I think that's actually harder than any public scrutiny, is if you feel that there are some people who think a female commentator is an awful idea and this is going to be a really bad idea, and the BBC are, you know, typical BBC for pursuing this and all that. So I did feel that. Nobody ever said anything to my face. You tend to read it in the Daily Mail if anybody was against you, which was a little...
this would be Charlie Sayles' column, would it?
Yeah. Yeah, and I read something about that. And it was quite unkind about... It was a little bit of negativity before. You know, I was doing Five Live, remember, for a while before Match of the Day came along. Mm. And I was doing matches every week for Five Live and Five Live Sports Extra. And another commentator who I very much suspected as being the one who was anti the idea actually rang me up and swore blind it wasn't him, and reassured me that he was all in favour and all the rest of it. And I just...
It wasn't me, was it?
No, you weren't at Five Live. But so I did sense it, to be completely honest. Nothing major, and most people were great. I mean, I'm very much a glass half full kind of person. I think you have to be in this industry. You can't let any negativity outweigh the positives, otherwise you really wouldn't get anywhere. And there were times I thought to myself, it would be so much easier if I was in a maybe a production role where you don't have that kind of pressure and scrutiny, or if I was in a different organization or different industry altogether. But don't forget, I'd had a lot of life experience before I came into journalism, and I think that really stood me in good stead. And the fact that I'd been the only female in the choir on the terrace when I was watching my team home and away every week, most of the women was down the front and what have you, and the fact that I'd been the only football fan in a pretty much in a whole school full of girls, and then I'd gone to a sixth form where there were 200 boys and 25 girls, and there are only a couple of us really into football. And so I was used to, and then going to university at 17 and being completely obsessed with football. So I was quite, and sometimes going on the coaches and maybe being the only female there if people I was with, you know, they were the lads from the school, or if I'd gone on my own because nobody wanted to go to that midweek trip to Grimsby or whatever it was. So I was quite used to maybe being an outlier in that regard. And that didn't put me off. I was just used to that. And I think I am fairly mentally strong, generally speaking, and not always, of course, and things could get to you. And yes, there were times I really, really, really did feel the weight of the world on my shoulders. I did in radio, never mind when TV came along, but I wasn't going to give up. I really felt I was there for the right reasons. I really felt that I'd taken every step I possibly could.
Hey, Jack, when you've slept on somebody's floor, for, you know, and various, wasn't just one person's floor, was it? It was several of you. Then you're ready for anything.
Yeah, so I felt that I was in it for the right reasons. I felt I could do the job, absolutely. And yeah, I'd done everything I could. And then when an opportunity comes along to do a single Match of the Day, as it wasn't a job. Like, people assumed I'd been handed a job, and all these articles on it was complete nonsense. I'd been given a job. I'd been asked to do one game as a freelancer who was already working every week for Five Live. So that's how it was. And I think it was mostly the misinformation that was a problem, rather than any, certainly not really peer pressure that put me off. And then reading stuff that was just absolute nonsense because there wasn't that information out there. And I wasn't doing any interviews, so I wanted to just be a journalist. I wanted to just be a commentator like everybody else. You didn't see Guy Mowbray talking about being a commentator or being a male commentator or Steve Wilson. But all those guys, I have to say, were so supportive. So any sort of tiny feeling of there's reticence about this, it's a terrible idea, slight feeling, massively outweighed by the positives. And I've always got on brilliantly with the other commentators at Five Live, really, really well, and TV, and they all rang me up that week during the craziness. They all rang me up. Motti, Steve Wilson, they were all so supportive. And on the match day, the first one, Nigel Adderley was in the press box that day, and he was like, I cannot believe this week, it's just insane. And it was just a case of getting through it. I got through it, and then the next one I did at Anfield, it was great because all the cameras were facing the pitch and not me anymore. Sometimes you just have to get through the tricky things, and then life becomes a little calmer, and then you just get on with your job, which is what it's all about.
Well, more power to you, Jackie. More power to you. And I couldn't be more thrilled at how things have gone.
Yeah.
That difficult early period and some of the stuff that the newspapers did was unforgivable. But let's move on from that, because it's been covered time and time again. Rob, let's get back to the Euros and 2016 and your first trip abroad. It's only France, but it is a trip abroad for 2 or 3 weeks. So you must have sat at home at every World Cup and Euros, you know, watching the coverage and harumphing, going, oh, stuff this, I wish I was out there. So being in amongst it, and I'm not long got into tournament football as a commentator. I'd done South Africa and Brazil, but I'd not done a Euros up to that point. So I was just as wide-eyed as you were. How did the reality live up to the fantasy?
Oh, it was just phenomenal. First of all, unlike others, sort of organisations, broadcasting organisations covering other countries, Wales picked a place called Dinard to be based in. It was idyllic. For the journalists, Wales were really good. The camp was close to where we were all staying. You know, on practical issues, there was a brilliant laundrette where I used to do a Facebook blog virtually every day. And there were restaurants, different types of restaurants. So different, again, we were on the coast, so there was a beach as well. There was a big football game one night involving all the journalists and others and the pundits. And so Wales pulled a blinder with that. I think Holland were due to go there. They didn't qualify, so Wales took their training camp. So that was fantastic. So we were in France, but we travelled to games and then go back to this place, Dinard. And the thing was, we didn't know when it was going to end. We didn't know what was going to happen. And even before that, it was surreal. I've got to tell you this one. Qualified in the October, November. Of course, the tournament is the following summer. I was my mother-in-law's, when my phone went, and it was somebody who I initially thought was a wind-up, and they said, we're just wondering whether we have your permission to use your commentary at the end of the game in Bosnia when Wales qualified on a Manic Street Preachers record. And I said, I sort of looked at my phone and I said, oh, it took me a long time to decide, like 0.5 of a second. Yeah, fine, that's okay. Yeah, I don't mind, really don't mind. If you want to use it, fine, that's great. And of course, it ended up, I thought it was a wind-up. I thought it was somebody winding me up. And then somebody from the office rang me and said, have you had a call from the Mannix people? And I said, actually, yes. And they said, well, it is legit. And so that was surreal in itself. We sort of did a concert, which I'd never hosted anything like that before, the BBC Welsh Orchestra, playing all the tunes that the fans had made up about the players and just going through, telling the story of qualification. Then we get to, via Sweden for a friend, we get to France. And I remember going to Toulouse for the Russia game. Wales didn't know, A, whether they were going home that night, if they'd lost, or whether they were going somewhere finishing second or somewhere finishing first. So we didn't have a clue where we were going. There was someone back at base doing all the hard work. So Wales romped through against Russia in Toulouse, and they're busy checking where we'd be next and then having to sort out hotels and accommodation for that. And it just went on. And it was my eldest birthday while we were out there. And my daughter actually put on Facebook, my dad says he'd love to be home, and also my birthday on the semi-final day. And just think before the quarterfinals, she said, well, I know my dad says he'd like to be home for his birthday, but actually, we do know he'd rather be out there celebrating his birthday. And she was spot on, and that's what happened. It was fantastic. It was, as I said, never to be forgotten. I could go on hours about life in France, but it was something else.
Do you know what, Jackie? It was easy for me to have a perspective on not just Rob, but when I looked at the faces of people like Robbie Savage and Owen Tudor Jones, it wasn't just the players, it was the pundits who were living their life vicariously through these Welsh players who were, well, doing their country proud doesn't tell the half of it, does it? It was just, I was just, the Slovakia game and Gareth Bale's free kick, and it just, those are moments that are indelibly stamped on my memory. I remember I had to go to Cardiff, because I'd come home by the time you're in the semis. I had to go to Cardiff and find somebody Portuguese to talk to. So I ended up going to the Nando's just off Chip Alley on Caroline Street. And as luck would have it, the guy flipping the chicken in the Nando's was Portuguese. So I managed to get an interview with the one poor Portuguese bloke in Cardiff ahead of the semi-final as a reporter. It was an amazing month.
It was brilliant. I remember seeing Rob in the press box in Lens for the England-Wales game, and I was so happy to see him. I'm always really happy to see Rob. We're always like long-lost friends, aren't we, whenever we meet up in press boxes. And that's one of my favourite things about this job, by the way, is the press box, because it's always sociable, and it's something we really missed during COVID times, wasn't it? We were so fortunate during Operation Restart that we got to go to games, but I really missed the social side. But back to the point of seeing Rob in that press box in Lens, and I was really lucky to be there for ITV. And it was just brilliant, because as a commentator, whoever you cover, obviously you're completely reliant on them being successful for you to get to go to big games. That's just how it works, obviously. So when you see people in the Premier League and a team who's not normally in the Premier League is there, then it's a really big deal for the commentators as well, because suddenly you're getting much better food every Saturday or Sunday than you were the previous week, year. And of course, we all know it's all about the spread, isn't it, Rob?
And the food was very good in the Wales camp as well. They knew we were working there, but so it brought it home to me, Jackie, right? It wasn't in France, actually. It was the night we qualified in Zenica. So we bought some beers on the way to the game because we were in a dry hotel about 10, 15 miles away from the game, just in case Wales qualified. Went back to the hotel, and I'm sat there with you and Roberts, of course, and Kevin Ratcliffe, who was my summariser, and a couple of others. And we had a few beers after they qualified. And I said to Kevin Ratcliffe, he's been capped 59 times for Wales. He's one of the great Wales players of all time. Played in a team in Neville Southall, Ian Rush, Mark Hughes, Dean Saunders, Ryan Giggs. I said, you never qualified. I said, don't you feel just a bit of jealous, even bitterness, envy of these guys? And he said, no, we didn't deserve it. They did. And from that moment, it really struck home to me how much it meant. And just a little moment like that means so much, doesn't it? You know, it's what people don't see, if you see what I mean. And likewise, in the press box. You know, we lived every day in France, and the same in the Euros this time, in Baku and Amsterdam. And we were all absolutely gutted. We couldn't go back to Baku this time because Wales lost to Denmark. And it's a joy, isn't it? I keep saying it, it's my passion, but it's my job as well. How lucky are we?
Yeah, I had Danny Gabaldon was my wingman for those stage games. And you could see, because he was just developing as a broadcaster as well. He was just coming through. He'd not long retired. And you could see the excitement. He was in that Welsh squad at the start of the qualification campaign. And there he is, poor bugger, after sitting alongside me in Bordeaux for the first game against Slovakia. But I loved it that I don't normally commentate. I don't know what you're like, Jackie or Robert. I'm not normally a fan of when a goal goes in, you're trying to commentate and your summariser jumps all over the top of you screaming. You know, it happens, doesn't it? That's what, when Gareth Bale scored his free kick, Danny Gabaldon, I've never heard it was blood-curdling, the scream that came out of his mouth. And my headphones nearly fell off because of the sheer volume of it. But that's what it did to someone like him. And that's, I mean, I don't know whether you get, when you were at the Euros or the World Cup for England's women, Jackie, whether you got, you know, that level of just the sheer, oh my God, they could do this, you know, this could actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, my first tournament I commentated on for the BBC was Euro 2005, which was a little remembered tournament in the northwest of England. And they had to keep it in the northwest because they couldn't make the marketing count throughout the whole country. They had to focus it on a small area because it was, of course, very much in developmental stage. And I remember the first game against Finland at the Etihad, as it's now called. And it was 0-0 till stoppage time, and Karen Carney, if you recall, scored a brilliant winner. She was 17 years of age and she went off, she scored it, curled it in the top right hand corner, started swearing a head off, which she got told later on for a month. And I went a little bit nuts in commentary, and I had Alistair Yeomans, the producer, next to me, having to tell me to sit down and calm down. Yes, absolutely right. But I got carried away, never mind the summariser. And because it meant so much. It meant so much. Yes, I really wanted those players to do really well. I really cared about them. And of course, you do have to contain yourself in those big moments. The summariser, I think it's quite nice on occasion, for a massive occasion, if the summariser does lose the plot and cuts across you and yelps. You know, Gary Neville does it very occasionally. But that's really significant of that moment, as long as they're not doing it literally every week for a bog standard.
Fernando Torres for Chelsea and Barca, wasn't it? There was that long drawn out scream that Gary did whilst Alan Parry's trying to commentate. Yeah, I remember that all too well. We're running a little bit short of time, so I want to get the last couple of questions in with you both. Rob, you've looked after a phone in, but call Rob. It's an institution now in Wales. And by institution, I don't mean that people get committed to it. As a commentator, obviously you have to change hats, and we'll talk about this with Jackie as well, because Jackie has to change hats. She's as much of a host of broadcasts. So the dynamic between switching from a commentary that you've just done for 2 hours and the adrenaline that's buzzing, and then you've got to do a phone-in.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've got usually two pundits with me. It can be manic for that half hour when the game finishes at five, if it's a club afternoon. Game finishes at five, I got to write an intro and then get ready to broadcast again. Plus, I like to tweet out questions because I think social media is huge now. And we actually judge a phone-in, not just on how many calls we get, but how many texts and tweets we get these days, which is how phone-ins have changed. And of course, we mainly talk Swansea, Cardiff, Newport and Wrexham, but they might throw a question on the Cymru Prem or women's football as well, because we use our pundits, you know, like Gwen and Harris who and people like that. So, and Helen Ward. So you've got to be across it, but it's brilliant fun because there's a certain sort of fan who will ring phone-ins, but after Wales games, they're brilliant because you get such a different atmosphere, a different clientele, if you want to put it that way. You know, all the Wales games are played in Cardiff, most of them anyway. And so you might get families travelling back home. So we've had youngsters on, you know, 7 and 8 year olds who've been to their first Wales game. That's just a joy. And then last season, we had Mike Flynn's wife ring in she actually texted her and we rang when they got into the playoffs, when they were at Southend. And Victoria was fantastic when Newport made the playoffs. She just brought a real sort of depth to it all and an emotion to it all, just how proud she was of what her husband had done again. So, yeah, it's opened up. It's strange. I think people in Wales might probably know me more for my phone-ins than maybe sometimes commentary, other than big events like the Euros, you know, when some lines people still throw at me now. But, It gets the adrenaline going. It means a late night every Saturday, but it's well worth it because I love it. I love it.
I agree with you. I love doing it. You've never done a phone-in, have you, Jackie, or have you?
Yeah, I've done 606.
Ah.
I love that because you talk about it takes a certain type of person, Rob, to call in a radio station. Well, I've done that a few times.
Have you?
As a kid, yeah. I used to ring Franksy on BBC WM. It's Jackie from Codsall. What's to talk about? Graham Turner. Yeah, and also rang, I don't think anybody knows this actually, I rang David Meller on 606 and I think Danny Baker as well.
Oh,
and I always remember, yeah, I remember Danny, sorry, David Meller, Red Hot Soccer Chat. And he, and I rang him up to talk about a defeat at Oldham, I think. I think I was, I can't remember that, I might have done a couple, so my memory's really hazy, so it was a very, very long time ago. And, and I remember he made a joke about Peter Shirtliff and John DeWolf, and he said something about Peter and DeWolf or something. And I think I don't give up the toe job, David. But yeah, it was really strange times.
You're going to get up with coffee, F. Crikey.
but yeah, I love doing 606. I think, I can't remember if I did a couple maybe, and it was, yeah, with Righty. It was absolutely brilliant. Just a brilliant concept. And
you're in good hands with Righty every single time.
Yeah, yeah, he's fantastic. But I think because I'd been a fan going home and away every week and had bought tickets for 30 years and what have you, I think it was, I totally understood what the fans were talking about when they were phoning up and talking about not being able to spend loads of money on five successive away Man City games. It's like, well, yeah, that's normal, right?
We've got to know you, Jackie, these days as much as a host of live sport on television as a commentator. Unfortunately, our paths never cross at the darts. Because I love doing the dart stuff that I do on the radio for Talk Sport. But when it comes to the World Championships or the World Match Play, that's not one that you would cover for ITV, but you're there for the UK Open down at Minehead and other ITV darts tournaments. How much do you enjoy being a host of a show as opposed to commentating?
I love both, but they're very, very different. And the reason I love presenting... and also TV commentary, I'd say, is I love being part of a team. I'm somebody that likes to chat during the week about how we can make our coverage better. And I love having the director and the producer and ITV Darts. My goodness, is that a sociable place to be? And the pundits, Chris Mason, Alan Warren a little. We get on really, really well. And we are a real team. The producers, the cameramen, the sound men. We just love seeing each other when we meet up. But in terms of the actual role, I love presenting because I like asking questions predominantly. I like getting interesting lines out of people. And constantly, even in commentary, I'm always thinking about a news line. I'm always thinking about, I do ask the summariser questions during commentary and I try not to make it presenter style because obviously you've got a game to commentate on and things could change any minute. But certainly when you have a break in play, it's always a case of what will the manager be thinking now? What might she be changing or he changing at half time? And what's your thoughts on blah or analysis on this? And so I really fell into presenting after I'd had children because I was asked to, really. And I think as when you're freelance, you go where the work is. And if people ask you to present rather than commentate, then you say yes, please, and you get on with it. And I loved it in that regard. There's a lot less prep in presenting. I have to be honest, this is slightly controversial, but it's a lot easier presenting than commentating. I really enjoy it, but I find it so much easier. I feel very natural presenting. I feel very at home. I don't get nervous. I love working with pundits. But when you're commentating, there's just so much more prep and having two young children and school runs to do every single day. You're basically sorting children between 6 a.m. and 9:30. You start work and you look up and suddenly it's 2:30. You've got to go and get the kids and sort them out and do their tea and help them with homework until 8:30 p.m. and then pick up work again afterwards. So with all the prep that I'm doing now, and I am presenting also Quest EFL highlights or EFL Cup highlights, whichever it may be, midweek as well at the moment. And so it is a juggle between the two. But in terms of the disciplines, I don't feel any, I don't feel like it's that hard work switching between the two. I love doing both of them. And I'm also doing a podcast series for The Athletic as well, interviewing people for that. So yeah, I love all different forms of it. But the commentary I love because you can really get immersed in the prep. And I've had to be really disciplined with my time, hence setting up camp up here and switching off from the rest of the world. I've learned to switch my mobile phone off. I'm reading a brilliant book called Deep Work by Cal Newport, which is really about the art of concentration and not being distracted in a distracting world. And so social media goes off for a while and take the emails off the laptop and that kind of thing. But when you're constantly juggling having to pay for kids' clubs and parties and getting presents in for the weekend parties and stuff, I do find that the biggest challenge, no matter what role I'm doing. But particularly for commentary, that's the biggest challenge. So hence, at the moment, I'm working every minute of every day, evenings, mornings, weekends, literally the whole time. So
it's that classic question, Jackie. So what do you do in the week then?
Yes, it's hilarious.
How many times do we get that? All commentators. So what do you do when you, I mean, the games are Saturday. You might have one on a Tuesday. What else do you do?
Yeah.
Easiest job in the world.
I've got prep to do for this Manchester derby on Saturday, and I've not started yet, and that's going to take a lot of work because, you know, the knowledge has to be there, particularly with the women's game being at the stage that it's at. You have to give it the respect it deserves, just as much as you would a Papa John's trophy game like I did on Tuesday in Lincoln, or a Premier League game at Everton as I did a couple of weeks before that. Rob, you have to travel a lot. Living in Wales and following Cardiff, Newport, Swansea and Wrexham, as you do, that does mean that you, as a Welshman living in South Wales, have to travel more than most commentators every other week.
Yeah, it's but I quite like it. I mean, you know, I know the motorway services. Do you remember the, what's the, there was, the name escapes me now, the pro... Gavin and Stacey. Yeah, how can I forget that? Gavin and Stacey, the Christmas edition, they said, well, you never stop at Heston services. It's got to be Reading or Membury. Or... And that is right up my street. So for all those listening, want to know the best services, Reading has to be number one for me. But Donington Park, treasure trove, a secret treasure trove, not on everybody's radar, but a must for me on the way back from the north.
I found that one, I was coming back from a Welsh game, I think it was Newport, coming back along the M4, I was diverted onto the M48.
Orst.
Service area there, I can't tell you what it's called, but it's the land that time forgot.
Just off the old Severn Bridge, Orst Services, that's the one you're looking for? Never go there.
It's tiny.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Too close to home for me.
It's a 1970s... service station that's been touched by human hand for 30, 40 years.
But how good is it now, though, that we have Waitrose and M&S in these services for our health and well-being? Because, as you know, travelling up and down the motorway the whole time, if you're living off Ginster's pasties, that's not going to do your waistline or health generally any good. But now we have options, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't beat Gloucester or T-Bay for me.
They
are top of the shop. Top of the shop. We used to, in the Kiss tribute band, we used to travel up to Glasgow, but we'd always stop at T-Bay for lunch because we, you know, we'd have a lovely view of the ducks in the pond outside, regardless of anything else.
It's the life of a commentator, but why wouldn't you like it? I always say to people, you know, one, if you don't work Saturdays, get a job in a bank. You want to work 9 to 5, work in a bank. But actually, if you don't want to travel, don't get into football or sport, because it's all about traveling. And to me, it's all part of the joy. And you never know who you're going to meet in these services, do you? Frank Worthington in McDonald's years ago, I think. I saw her before a game. It's just fantastic.
Jackie, just one more for you, because you've got so much more left to achieve in broadcasting, whether it's as a commentator or as a host. You must be incredibly proud of what your impact has brought in the sense that Robin Cowan, Vicky Sparks, Flo Lloyd-Hughes and others are coming through and showing such great skill and picking up the baton and normalising the situation. Do you know what I mean? Just meaning that you're not unique. There are more female commentators like you who are, you know, making that landscape so much more equal.
It's really, really heartening now seeing and hearing female commentators without it being a big drama. That's the key thing. And there's Emma Jones, who's been doing it for a while at BBC London as well. Pian Mullenstein, who you might recognise the name, at MUTV, for example. And so that's the good thing about it, is that listening to DAZN's coverage and hearing female commentators, it just feels normal now. And all I ever asked is that we were judged on our own merits, not on our gender. Because if there's a male commentator you don't like, you don't go, oh, bloody male commentators, can't believe they allow them on, do you? It's absurd. So why would you, if you didn't like me, why would you then think, well, I hate female commentators? So I think we have moved past that now, and it's just great that there are more opportunities as well to broadcast. I heard Robin on your Fine podcast recently talking about how she started doing women's football commentary on TV a decade or so ago on the Red Button. And I think that's fantastic. The fact there are more options to do that under the radar, if you like, to be able to get your air miles in and or in local radio without it being a big drama. But I think that's all we want, really, is just to be able to be judged on our merits. Nothing more. I don't want any handouts. We don't need jobs just for the sake of it. It's not like that. And it doesn't work like that, as we know. You have to earn your stripes. And yeah, just normalising it, I think, is just the minimum that we quite like.
Yeah, you were a trailblazer, Jackie. You were a trailblazer. And that is... on the back of that, so much has happened, and it's just enriched football, really. I'm not just saying that because you're on here, but, you know, you deserve an awful lot of credit because you were the first. You made the breakthrough, and somebody always has to do that.
Well, thanks, Rob. But I think rather than it being me, I think it was more a case of it sparked that debate, which had been kept behind closed doors and nobody had really talked about because they hadn't had to before. So those phone-ins, the front page stories, more phone-ins, TV, radio, everything during that week. Okay, so it wasn't pleasant for me, but just take my personal feelings out of it. Maybe people just needed to get out in the open this discussion. And remember, it was only really a debate because Harry Bassett had said everybody in football's against this. And Steve Curry, the late Steve Curry from the Mail, wrote about how nobody wants to hear a foghorn and a fire siren. And he apologised to me shortly before he died, saying, look, they asked me to write that. I hope you understand, type thing. And it was good to have the conversation, and the debate was had. And I think most of the debate was really about the absurdity of it all. So it wasn't so much everybody was attacking me. It was the fact that that debate came out and people said, no, it shouldn't be allowed. And the craziness of that conversation. So I'm just glad that it's out the way, and if it had to be me that was the fall guy for it, so be it. I've got broad shoulders now. I'm better off with the experience, and more to the point, thank goodness it's just not a thing anymore, anywhere near as much, at least.
Spot on.
Yeah, and it, what will happen is I'll go to Lee Sports Village on Saturday, Jack, and I'll bump into a whole new set of, you know, people in the press box who have, you know, been there for the growth of the WSL, and I will, it's like Rob says, you never stop learning. I'll be soaking up information like a sponge from those guys and what they've done and the women who are getting involved in the press for that. So it's a wonderful development in the way that football's gone in this country, that people like you have paved the way for what we see now. It's great to see.
Quickly, before we go, Dan, so I got to tell you this. Jackie rang me a few weeks ago. She said, talking about cooperation with commentators and reporters, she rang up and she said, what can you tell me about Bruno Longs, the new Wolves manager? And do you know what? I could barely remember him from when he was with Carlos Carvajal at Swansea. So I was of absolutely no use to you there, Jackie. Or...
You usually are, Rob. You're usually very, very helpful for any...
Sorry about that.
Any Welsh football chat, but... No. But there is great camaraderie amongst commentators. That's one of the fun things, and reporters. And Dan, I love seeing you in press boxes around the country. It's not very often, but if I go to St Andrews or wherever. And you never know who's going to pop up where, but I do love the social side and the press room side.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to getting back into press rooms. I've been mostly straight onto the gantry recently, but that is the fun thing. And one of the things I'm enjoying about this pod, Dance, is hearing people's journeys. But can you please ask people more about their prep and how they do it? Because I'm absolutely fascinated by how everybody else is doing, because I'm very much a digital kind of girl and I use every gadget going to give me any kind of advantage compared to the previous week.
Probably just got time to ask you this then, Rob. I mean, you were in the internet age when your radio commentary prep started. So a website like Soccerbase would have been around, for example, I imagine, for you to get data from.
Yeah.
But it was in its infancy, wasn't it? So
Oh, in the old days on newspapers, you'd ring up the other guy on the news, or woman at the news, usually a guy then, actually. Newspapers were the same. You'd ring, so say if I was doing a Cardiff game and they were playing Doncaster, I'd ring the Doncaster news person, whoever covered Doncaster. So it's so much better now. But as I said to you earlier, the big change for me was going from writing everything out to typing everything out and have it on stencils and all that sort of stuff now.
Yeah, I might have to take the plunge with this, you know. I'm still such
small step for man, dance, giant leap for mankind. That for me.
All right,
coin a phrase.
It's going on my Christmas list, Rob. I think
I'll send you my template dance, and you can have a laugh at that. But I do always send.
I'm going to have to call you, Jackie, and get some information on Manchester United women and Manchester City women. I think
sure,
it's got to be
help. Done. Yeah.
Listen, guys, it's been so lovely speaking to you, and we've gone for well over an hour, but it's been a fascinating hour, and thank you so much for giving up your time to join me on the Commentator's Curse. Jackie, enjoy your weekend, your Super Sunday with
thank
the
Patel.
That'll be a great little doubleheader for you to get involved in. And Rob, you've of course got Welsh action. You've got a press conference you're about to take
on. Yeah, Rob Page and Daniel James following in 10 minutes.
There you go. So I'll let you go and make a cup of tea and do what you have to do. Sort out your ablutions before that gets going. Jackie, Rob, what a pleasure. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Rob Phillips and Jackie Oatley, my guests on the Commentator's Curse this week. The archive's there for you to listen to all the previous episodes. And the next episode, I think episode 8, I've lost track. It'll be out next week at the same time. Thanks for your company. My thanks once again to Rob Phillips and Jackie Oatley. You've been listening to The Commentator's Curse.